making sure that ships loaded with Ukrainian foodstuffs reach famine-prone countries in Africa and Asia. Zelensky's hoping that if he keeps pushing the UN, he can get some of those member states who are kind of on the fence to back Ukraine.
All right, now let's assume for just a second that they find a way to go ahead with this idea of a peace summit. Any reason at all to think that it could help change the direction of the war?
It's unlikely. Ukraine has been talking for quite a bit about how a negotiated settlement would look. You might remember back in March, Ukrainian and Russian negotiators appeared to be getting pretty close to some sort of negotiated settlement, but Ukraine began to reclaim territory, and all these atrocities began emerging. You might remember Bucha, and that was the end of that. I remember going with my NPR colleagues to visit Ukraine's top negotiator in the spring, and this negotiator said, "Of course Ukraine wants to negotiate, but only after things play out on the battlefield." And that's basically what Kuleba told the AP yesterday. He said, quote, "Every war ends on the battlefield and at the negotiating table."
That's NPR's Julian Haidar. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Just last week, any type of compromise between Russia and Ukraine seemed out of the question. Let's ask Daniel Fried what's changed. He's a former U.S. ambassador to Poland, now the Wiser Family Distinguished Fellow at the Atlantic Council. Ambassador, why do you think both sides are talking negotiations now?
I wouldn't hold my breath for negotiations to get started. The Russians have maintained a maximalist position that negotiations have to start with a recognition of the territories they've tried to conquer and don't even control. That's a ridiculous position and an aggressive one. The Ukrainian position is that negotiations start with the Russian withdrawal and justice for Ukraine, which is a much more reasonable position. But the fact is, this war, as Foreign Minister Kuleba has said, will be decided on the battlefield before you get to negotiations. Both sides still think that they can, if not win, at least do better. The Russians think that they can wear down the Ukrainians by attacking their infrastructure, which they're doing. And the Russians also hope that U.S. and Western support for Ukraine will crumble. The Ukrainians believe that they can keep liberating territory. And remember, since the beginning of this war, the Ukrainians have outperformed everybody's expectations and the Russians have underperformed. So the Ukrainian hope to liberate more of their territory, save more of their people, is a reasonable hope. I think the Ukrainians, by proposing this UN meeting, are trying to get the discussion away from the Russian demands as a starting point and over to their side, which is not a bad tactic. And let's remember, these aren't two equal sides. Putin started this war for no good reason, and he's not winning it. The Ukrainians are fighting for their lives and their country, and they're doing all right. It's a good investment to back the Ukrainians, but don't hold your breath for diplomacy, at least not yet.
Right. You called Ukraine's demands more reasonable, a lot more reasonable than Russia's demands, but that would be factoring in a huge ego blow to Vladimir Putin. So given that possibility, how realistic do you think it is to have those demands met before negotiations happen?
Well, you're right that Putin has staked his leadership and maybe his life on success in Ukraine. But nobody told him he had to start this war. The U.S. warned him that he'd better not or we would back Ukraine. The Biden administration was pretty very clear about that. When Russian leaders start wars that they don't win, Russian history tells us, bad things can happen. That's true. But it's not Ukraine's responsibility to make life easier for Vladimir Putin. They're fighting for their lives. Putin is fighting for his imperial vanity and some vision of Russian glory from the past. That's no reason to start displacing millions of people and killing tens of thousands. It's a bad and ugly war that Putin has started. And we're right to back Ukraine. It's not charity, as President Zelensky told Congress last week. It's a good investment in a world order that happens to be in America's national interest.
Ukraine looks to the U.S. for global leadership. You've written that, Ambassador. What part do you see the U.S. possibly playing in all this?
The U.S. certainly has reemerged again as the leader of the free world. Whatever we looked like after the chaotic withdrawal from Afghanistan, the Ukrainians look to us with good reason as the indispensable nation. And so we are. We're their biggest backer. We've rallied the West. Other countries have joined us in a big way, Poland, the UK, and France and Germany have done a lot too. But the U.S. is going to be the key player. That's why Zelensky came here last week and not to Brussels or Berlin or Paris. The U.S. role is critical. And I believe the administration has encouraged Ukraine to make clear its terms for a diplomatic settlement, which the Ukrainians have done. And I think one of the topics that President Zelensky covered with the Biden administration is how to make their peace plan more visible. And I think we are seeing the results of that this week with Kuleba's proposal. But we're still in the phase of sparring rather than actual negotiating. For real negotiations to start, I want to see some sign that the Russians have fallen off their maximum position.
And you'd need to see or hear that before you would think that any possibility of these negotiations being productive would actually happen.
Exactly. The Russians aren't fools. When they want to negotiate, they know how. Right now, and I've been dealing with them since the Soviet period, they don't want to negotiate. They want to win. But when they want to negotiate, they do know how, and that's what I'm waiting for.
Former U.S. Ambassador and Distinguished Fellow at the Atlantic Council, Daniel Freed, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Some frogs are tiny and transparent, just like crystal figurines. Now, appropriately enough, they're called glass frogs, and they can achieve near total invisibility. Scientists now have a window into how they do it. NPR's Ari Daniel tells us more.
A few years back, Jesse D'Elia, now a biologist at the American Museum of Natural History, was in Panama. He was wrapping up a field study on a type of glass frog, and he brought a handful of these translucent frogs, each no bigger than a half-dollar coin, to the lab for a photo shoot.
I wanted to get some photos of the glass frog bellies, and so I put them in petri dishes. You could see the circulatory system. It was red, with red blood cells.
And then it wasn't.
When I came back later, it was gone. It was crazy.
As if the arteries and veins filled with red blood had just melted away. He then took a video of the glass frog's pumping and seemingly bloodless heart. D'Elia sent it to his collaborator, Carlos Taboada, a biologist at Duke University.
It was colorless. It was insane.
Not even the telltale red streak of a vessel in the frog's belly was visible.
I had never seen anything like that.
The biologists wanted to know, how did the frogs hide their blood? Where did all those red cells go? In a new paper out in the journal Science, D'Elia says they now have an answer.
They hide most of their red blood cells in their liver?
Their liver, which is coated in reflective crystals. During the day, while the glass frogs are asleep on green leaves, they're vulnerable to predators, so they cram their livers full of red blood cells to become super transparent, far less visible to those who'd eat them. As they sleep, those red cells transport very little oxygen.
It means that they probably have some specialized metabolism, some alternative process that allows them to keep their cells alive during transparency.
Then, at night, when the frogs become active and they're going about their regular business of feeding and mating, the amphibians release their red blood cells back into circulation. In the dark, predators no longer rely on visual cues. Rather, they detect vibrations in the leaves or use chemical signals. Once it's daytime, the cycle begins anew. Carlos Taboada again.
They pack like 90% of their red blood cells in a really, really small volume. Normally, those conditions can trigger, like, some clotting disorders.
It's a remarkable adaptation that allows these little frogs to pull off their vanishing act. Ari Daniel, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
You're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning, 8:19 on this Tuesday now. Food banks say inflation is increasing demand while making it more expensive to keep shelves stocked, and donations aren't going as far. How inflation is forcing food banks to cut back. That's coming up later this hour on Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio.
WPR has been a radio pioneer since 1917. That's more than a century of information, connection, and inspiration for the people of Wisconsin. When you give, you ensure that WPR's bright future includes plenty of in-depth news, world-class music, and thought-provoking discussions and entertainment. Thank you for supporting the important role of WPR in your community with your year-end gift right now at WPR.org/donate.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin-Madison, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, UW Parkside will offer a crime scene investigation course, Critical Thinking in Death Scene Investigations. From January 9th to the 15th, the course caters to all levels of experience. For more info, contact 262-595-2402.
Public radio at 8:20. In weather, wind chills below zero to start today, but eventually temperatures reaching the mid-20s throughout the state with a little bit of light snow in the north. A warm front moves in tomorrow with a light wintry mix in the north and temperatures in the 30s throughout the state. Rain and wintry mix continuing Thursday with temperatures near 40 across Wisconsin. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Procter & Gamble, maker of Z-Quil Pure Z's Gummies, designed with melatonin for occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep naturally. Learn more at zquil.com. And from the Pew Charitable Trusts, now airing a new season on the intersection of race and research on Pew's podcast, After the Fact, available at pewtrusts.org/NPR. And from the George Gund Foundation, working to make Cleveland and Northeast Ohio more globally competitive, livable, sustainable, and just. More information available at gundfdn.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez. The Haitian government's request for an international armed force to help restore security has gone unanswered. Violent gangs are kidnapping, raping, and killing people, and cholera is spreading as many Haitians are facing starvation. In January, there will be more political uncertainty as there will be no elected lawmakers sitting in the country's Senate. The Miami Herald's Jacqueline Charles spoke to our co-host Leila Fadel about the situation in Haiti.
It's very difficult. Close to half the population right now does not have enough to eat. And there are about 20,000 people facing famine-like conditions. You know, you're talking about 34% of schools that are still closed. Over 100,000 people that have been displaced out of their home over the past year. And of course, with cholera, they suspect that they've reached 15,000 cases throughout the country's, you know, 10 regional departments.
What you're describing is so devastating. And then because of the gang violence, a lot of international aid organizations have also left the country. So what support do people in Haiti who need help have?
They have very little help. And you're right. A number of international aid organizations, they have left. They've been leaving quietly for some time now. Groups, you know, from South Florida, for instance, that used to travel down there elsewhere around the country to help children with heart problems or other ailments, they haven't been able to take any of these medical groups there. So really, you know, you're talking about a population that really has been left to fend for itself. And, you know, and let's be clear, this whole issue of foreign assistance, it triggers, you know, a lot of emotion for some people. There are some individuals who say, no way, you know, we don't want it. You know, you ask a Haitian, do you want a foreign occupation?
Because of the history of foreign intervention.
You know, but at the same time, when you talk to that mother who is worried about her child, and does she send her child out into the streets and because she's not sure if that child is going to come back, or does she herself take the risk? But you don't know, you know, are you going to make it back home alive?
If you could just lay out the history that feeds into the skepticism around international intervention.
Well, firstly, you have to talk about, you know, I think the Haitian Constitution, it's, you know, I mean, this is a country that was founded by former slaves, you know, when they revolted against France. So there's this whole issue of sovereignty. But in more recent times, you look at the United Nations that have had to step into Haiti, you know, with their peacekeeping operations over the years, and people have been critical about that. But you know, as a reporter on the ground, I've always said that when you have, you know, UN peacekeepers that have come into your country, their job and role is not to make everything right again. It's to create the political space and the stability and the security. It's called a stabilization force for a reason, in order to allow the Haitian actors to step into that space and to provide some guidance, governance, you know, some laws, you know, that will ensure that stability.
There's been political chaos since the assassination of Haitian President Jovenel Moïse in July 2021. In your reporting, how do Haitians feel about Prime Minister Ariel Henry's ability to handle this moment and the necessary political changes?
Prime Minister Ariel Henry has faced an uphill battle from the start in terms of leading this country. I mean, one, we have to remember that he was named by Jovenel Moïse, who at the time of his death was an increasingly unpopular president. And so Ariel Henry has always been viewed as aligned with Jovenel Moïse. He's never been able to be independent, and that has not helped him at all. At the same time, he has instituted some very unpopular measures, starting, of course, with this decision to raise the price of fuel. And when you talk to people, you know, they're looking at the situation in this country where the economy is in shambles, the political paralysis is increasing, you know, hunger is growing, and you've got this person there and they're not elected. But at the same time, when you talk to folks in the international community, what they're saying, okay, but you guys need to come up with a solution. You need to come up with a plan. And so what you find today is Ariel Henry is trying to bring together various groups around the table to see if they can come up with some sort of a plan to lead this country into a transition that will get it to elections. Can he do it? I don't know. Everybody is sort of watching it.
What is a Haitian led solution in the midst of all of this, all of these crises, economic, humanitarian, violence?
That's a very good question, right? Because what we have not been able to see since the assassination of Haitian President Jovenel Moïse, and this is something that even existed before that, is Haitians coming around the table and agreeing on, you know, some solutions. I mean, one of the solution or part of the solution that's been presented is this idea of getting foreign assistance on the ground to help strengthen your police so that they can provide some sort of quote unquote humanitarian corridor. But even in that, you see Haitians divided about that. And I think that is the key. It's like trying to get Haitians to come around a set of goals or, you know, a set of decisions or some sort of direction to say, okay, here are the necessary steps that we're going to take in order to move this country along. You have an international community which recently has turned to sanctions, but what they're really saying is we want reforms, you know? So I think that's the real challenge for Haitians today. Those who really do recognize what's happening and recognize that it can't continue to go on, sort of being able to compromise. And that's what the international community is asking. Is that going to happen in the new year? I don't know, because what's going to happen as of the second Monday in January is you're going to be looking at a country where there's absolutely not one elected official. Today, there are 10 elected members of the Senate, which is usually 30 people. Well, their mandates run out as of the second Monday. So you're looking at a country that is going to be faced with two choices, that it's either going to fall deeper and deeper into crisis and chaos, or it's going to elevate itself to say, okay, enough already. Let's figure out how to pull ourselves out of this and let's start to take the steps to do that.
Miami Herald reporter Jacqueline Charles on the very dire situation in Haiti. Thank you so much for your reporting.
Thank you for having me.
This is NPR News.
In some states, kids can be taken from their mothers and fathers forever if the parents fail to pay debts related to foster care, even debts they didn't know about.
I don't understand how we get three of our kids back and that one child is just gone.
What happens when parents try to fight back? This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That story, plus the day's news with Brady Carlson from 4 until 6:30 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.
This is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. It's 8:29. NPR has national headlines, state headlines from WPR, both on the way next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Officials in western New York are warning that they'll prosecute anyone involved in looting following a ferocious winter storm that has paralyzed the region. NPR's Brian Mann reports the death toll in that area has risen to at least 27.
Buffalo is slowly digging out, aided by President Biden's decision declaring a federal emergency. But a travel ban remains in place in some areas, and Mayor Byron Brown said at a press conference he's troubled by reports of looting.
So these aren't even people in distress. These are people that are taking advantage of a natural disaster and the suffering of many in our community to take what they want.
Upstate New York is expected to get another blast of snow today, with the area around Buffalo forecast for at least 3 inches, and Jefferson and Lewis counties facing around half a foot of additional snow. Brian Mann, NPR News in upstate New York.
Nationwide, officials report at least 49 weather-related deaths. There are thousands of homes and businesses still without power, and airlines continue to delay or cancel flights. Claude Classigal was supposed to spend Christmas with his family in Orlando, Florida. He's still at the airport in Los Angeles.
We've never experienced anything like it. I guess I'm not going to ever fly a flight that flies through Chicago during the winter.
He says he's hoping to get out by tomorrow. This is NPR News.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Alex Crow. The Menominee Indian Tribe of Wisconsin has relaunched efforts to bring a casino to Kenosha. Joe Schultz reports.
The Menominee and Hard Rock International hope to build a gambling operation in Kenosha. Hard Rock is owned by the Florida Seminole, but the Menominee have been trying to bring a casino to Kenosha since the 1990s. The tribe's chairman, Ron Korn, says the casino's revenue could improve life for the Menominee.
The Menominee have a whole lot of unmet need here on the reservation as it comes to health, education, housing.
But not all Wisconsin tribes approve. George Ermert is a spokesperson for the Potawatomi.
They do not want to see a tribe from Florida come in and take potentially hundreds of millions of dollars from Wisconsin.
The Menominee's last attempt was blocked by former Governor Scott Walker in 2015. Joe Schultz, Wisconsin Public Radio.
As we move towards the new year, a battle is brewing over funding in Wisconsin. Democratic Governor Tony Evers is preparing to release his two-year state budget proposal in February. He has said that his priorities include cutting income taxes for middle-class families and increasing funding for public education. But Republicans who control the Assembly and Senate want to see a flat tax income and expanded school choice program. The two sides will also have to decide on how to spend the state's projected $6.6 billion surplus. Evers met with Assembly Leader Robin Voss last week for the first time in nearly 2 years. He also met the week before that with Senate Majority Leader Devin LeMahieu. In weather, wind chills below zero across much of Wisconsin starting off the day, but eventually temperatures reaching the mid-20s across the state. Warm front moves in across Wisconsin tomorrow with a light wintry mix in the northern part of the state and temperatures in the low 30s in the north and upper 30s in the south. The warm-up continues Thursday, with temperatures expected to reach 40 degrees during the daytime across most of the state. Northern Wisconsin might see a light wintry mix, while the south can expect mostly rain Thursday. On Friday, the majority of the state expects mostly rain as well, with temperatures in the mid-40s in the south and mid-30s in the north. I'm Alex Crow. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil, a fiber supplement containing psyllium, a plant-based fiber for trapping and removing waste in the digestive system, designed to be taken every day. More at Metamucil.com. And from the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century.
and from the Annie E. Casey Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez. A boat carrying more than 180 Rohingya refugees has arrived in Indonesia. It's the second boat with refugees to do so in recent days. These members of the stateless, persecuted Muslim minority have been drifting for weeks without food or water before reaching shore. They fled from Bangladesh, where about 1 million Rohingya live in refugee camps after escaping a deadly military-led campaign targeting them in Myanmar. Joining us now is Babar Baluch, a spokesman for the UN Refugee Agency. First off, can you tell us in what state these refugees arrived in Indonesia?
Thank you for having me. These desperate people who arrived over the last 2 days are in bad shape, actually. Dehydrated, many of them being adrift for a month in those choppy waves. Without anything, without any help as well. So the first thing UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, my colleagues, local communities and authorities had to do was try to give them urgent attention. Many of them needed medical help, and majority of these people that landed yesterday ashore in Indonesia are women and children.
Were they at least relieved to be away from Myanmar?
They are relieved to be on safe land. And remember, as we have been saying, they have been adrift for a month. And when we say adrift for a month, it means they have been on a rickety wooden boat, which is not fit for sea travel at all. There have been reports of engine breakdowns on this boat that we are talking. This was specifically 200 on one boat. Out of 200, 174 arrived yesterday. 26 lost their lives during this ordeal.
Government officials said today in Bangladesh they're trying to stop refugees from risking their lives. This group of refugees made it to shore, others did not. What is your latest estimate on how many Rohingya refugees have died trying to make the journey?
Indeed, there can be a collective effort to restore hope in refugees' lives. And when we talk about these movements, there are reports that these are happening from Bangladesh, from Myanmar, but there is a reason for this happening. These are people who have to find safety and protection, and there are no legal ways for them to do that. Many of them see no hope for themselves in the refugee camp where UNHCR, us, with the local Bangladeshi authorities and communities have been working. Let's not forget that Bangladesh has been a generous host for 1 million Rohingya refugees. But these Rohingya refugees need humanitarian support to continue their lives. So as a refugee, when you don't see any kind of light at the end of the tunnel, you don't know what future holds for you. It just aggravates that sense of desperation. And added to that complex and difficult situation are the human smugglers and traffickers who are ready to prey on these desperate people. And this is what they do.
When you say there's no hope, or at least they have no hope in their situation, how bad is their situation in Bangladesh?
Inside the camps where you have 1 million people being supported day and night by local authorities in Bangladesh, the humanitarians, UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, but we are not getting internationally the required help. We need to take care of these people. Remember, many of them are children. You have women there. So there's people's future at stake as well. Majority of them, more than 700,000, arrived in 2017 from Myanmar. 5 years on, they don't know what's going to happen to them. So we have to collectively, and this is not only a call on the regional state, this is a global call to invest in these desperate refugees' lives so they see a future for themselves. We have been asking
but
for resources.
If they stay, I guess what I'm asking is if they stay, what do they face? What kinds of threats are they facing if they stay?
They are currently at a location which is very overcrowded. We have been continuously working to improve it. Remember, Bangladesh is one of the most densely populated countries. Land is an issue, but even after that, they have been able to step forward and host these refugees. What is not there is equal responsibility sharing and support globally from the international community.
That's Babar Baluch, spokesman for the UN Refugee Agency. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Food banks in the U.S. are feeling the pinch of inflation. The rising cost of groceries is forcing more people to seek help and making it more expensive for food banks to keep their shelves stocked. Ekta Prakash says some are having to cut back. She's the CEO of CAPI, a Minnesota nonprofit that serves immigrants and refugees in the Twin Cities.
If you were giving like 2 bags of bread, now we will give 1 bag of bread. If you're giving 20 lbs of rice, now we are going to give only 10 lbs of rice. So the poundage of food is also reducing.
Prakash says her organization is struggling to keep up with the growing demand.
Every week, we are seeing 8 to 10 new enrollments at our food shelf. I think about how are we going to cover the cost of food. And I remember there were days on Friday we used to have extra food. We'll do a bonus Friday, but not anymore.
Food banks are facing shortages, even as overall giving has stayed pretty consistent, according to Blackbaud Institute, a group that tracks philanthropy. Again, you can blame inflation. The money just isn't going as far. Lucy Lubois is still trying to make the best of it as she sets up for distribution. She's one of the founders of the DC Food Project.
That's the produce. We organize everything by numbers. We have very specific numbers per school. Our volunteers come, we pack cars, and everyone goes.
She says fundraising has dropped since the beginning of the pandemic.
Everyone was hoping and wanting to help if they could, and so we were able to raise money as fast as we were spending it.
And there are many organizations competing for donations.
People, even if they're generous, may want to donate to other causes. I think the food insecurity story was a really big one during the pandemic. And unfortunately, it still exists. And in fact, it's worse than before the pandemic. But the fundraising piece of it is challenging.
For some food banks, this holiday season has been one of the most challenging as the need in the community is as high as it was during the worst moments of the pandemic. This is NPR News.
Thanks for joining us here on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:42. Still to come on Morning Edition, in Rochester, Minnesota, police officers are volunteering as driver's ed instructors. It's part of a school program to get more teen drivers on the road legally and safely. That story is just 3 minutes away here on Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio.
PBS Wisconsin Education invites you to join a winter of wonder at pbswisconsin.org/education. Inspire curiosity with our free, fun, kid-tested programs, games, and hands-on activities for cold weather days. Count on PBS Wisconsin to be there wherever your winter adventures take you, at school, at home, or on the go on your TV, tablets, and mobile devices. Explore a wonderful world of education now at pbswisconsin.org/education.
Support for WPR comes from the Central Wisconsin Symphony Orchestra and Rutabaga Paddle Sports. Join the team of organizations that support a wide variety of informative and inspiring programs for the people of Wisconsin. More at WPR.org/sponsor.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the ADRC of Kenosha County presents its Medicare Minute, focusing on a wide range of Medicare topics and what's new for 2023. To participate, and more info, call 262-605-6646.
Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's a look at what's happening in news today. The number of people killed by a winter storm in the United States has risen to 49. More than half of those who died were in western New York.
Thousands of Southwest Airlines flights have been canceled again today across the country. The company is blaming that winter storm and says it's working to resolve the issues. Tens of thousands of people are stranded across the country as those cancellations continue. That includes in Wisconsin, where the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reports that nearly 30 flights were canceled at Milwaukee Mitchell International Airport yesterday. 27 of them were Southwest Airlines flights. Pictures posted online showed hundreds of bags sitting at baggage claim areas unclaimed as those passengers and their flights were grounded. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working together to create a just world where all people have access to renewable energy, clean air and water, and healthy food. On the web at theschmidt.org. From Noom, providing an online evaluation and the tools to help people lead healthier lives through behavior change. More information at Noom, Noom.com. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez. Learning to drive can be a liberating experience for young people and their parents, but some families don't have the time or money for driver's education. In Minnesota, Rochester Public Schools have found a solution. Police officers are volunteering their time to give driving lessons. Minnesota Public Radio's Catherine Richard reports.
It's a couple of days after Rochester's first big snow, and it's Joyce Belafonte's first winter drive.
Do you have any information about driving on snow and slush?
Yeah, you should drive slower.
That's Rochester Police Department investigator Chantel Powell, one of 20 cops volunteering to help students learn to drive. On this day, she's working with 17-year-old Belafonte, who needs 50 hours of practice to get her license.
Take turns and everything slower than what you, normally would.
Yeah, that's a cop in the passenger seat, part of a program to get more teens on the road legally and safely. A recent school district survey of driver's ed students found almost a third had driven without a license. Aaron Vasquez, an administrator at one of the participating high schools, says that can be for a lot of reasons. Their parents can't drive them. They need to get a job. They want to see friends.
You know, if a student gets a ticket, and if they're unable to pay that ticket, then it kind of snowballs. And then sometimes they get buried in fines. Sometimes they don't have access to employment because they don't have the ability to drive.
So last spring, with more than $117,000 in grants and cars donated by the county, the first driver's ed class began. Students pay what they can afford instead of the regular $400 class fee. That's a game changer for 15-year-old Ajulu Otho, who moved here recently from Kenya. There, many people didn't drive because they couldn't afford cars. So Otho sees a license as a way to get a job to help support her family financially.
Because my dad is the only one working right now. My mom just had a baby and she can't work. So this is a really big thing for us.
Welcome. All right. Did everybody get a booklet?
At Century High School, teacher Chris Jones says the driver's ed class is intense, 3 hours a day for 10 days.
The big barrier is getting the driving hours in. They have to have 50 hours in before they can take their license exam.
And that's where the Rochester Police Department steps in. When kids don't have a car for practice or an adult who can drive them, a police officer teaches them the ropes. Chief Jim Franklin says the new partnership helps get in front of a host of problems that can lead to crime and poverty, like not being able to drive to a job or an after-school activity. And he says it's helping cops and young people get to know each other at a time when tensions can be high between law enforcement and people in the neighborhoods they police.
There certainly is a community connectedness aspect to it, which does lead to building trust and legitimacy. But there's also a traffic safety nexus, having cops teach kids to be better drivers, which is extremely important for this community.
Back at her lesson, the rapport between Belafonte and Powell is clear. Belafonte calls Powell her cop lady, and Powell knows all about a tragedy in Belafonte's past. Her older brother was driving when he died in a car accident in 2017.
He didn't have his license yet. I wouldn't say boys and stupid decisions. I would just say young kids and making decisions that they think will turn out good, and sometimes they just don't.
Bella Font keeps driving. Powell reminds her to use her turn signal and then tells her she's doing great. For NPR News, I'm Catherine Richard in Rochester, Minnesota.
This is NPR News.
You're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning, it's 8:49. The latest news from NPR and WPR coming up just after 9 o'clock. Military recruitment is down around 25%, both nationally and in the Wisconsin National Guard. We'll hear about that in the newscast in 10 minutes. Then host Stephanie Elkins brings you Morning Classics on Wisconsin Public Radio.
WGTD is an affiliate of Wisconsin Public Radio and NPR, a cultural asset and a community resource. WGTD is owned and operated by Gateway Technical College, with additional financial support from the Wisconsin Public Radio Association and local underwriters whose customers value public radio.
Chapter 5. WPR is pleased to promote family-friendly fun. Find out more at wpr.org/events.
In sports, the Wisconsin Badgers football team is scheduled to play against Oklahoma State in the Guaranteed Rate Bowl tonight at 9:15. New head coach Luke Fickle will be there but will not be coaching. That'll be done by Jim Leonard, who will be leaving the program after the game. That game, by the way, is being played in a baseball stadium where the Arizona Diamondbacks call home. The Milwaukee Bucks have lost 3 games in a row. They're going to be taking on the Chicago Bulls tomorrow night at 7. The Wisconsin Badgers men's basketball team is up to number 15 in the nation. They'll play Western Michigan on Friday night. The women's team is scheduled to play on Thursday night against Illinois. In weather, wind chills below zero, a brisk start to the day, but temperatures warming up to mid-20s across the state by day's end. Tomorrow, temperatures expected in the mid-30s. This is WPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez. Hip-hop artist Lecrae raps about Jesus and Christianity on his new mixtape, Church Clothes 4. This music compilation that's looser and freer than a studio album explores racism, problems in the church, police brutality, and abortion. I spoke with Lecrae earlier about when he became a Christian.
I was 17. I had a pregnancy scare. I had gotten in some trouble with the law. I got arrested, was immature. Being a rebellious, kind of mischievous kid, didn't grow up with his father. And started asking some questions about purpose, about life, and that led me down a religious journey. And that's where I heard the message of Christ and was, you know, had a spiritual transformation.
So how did hearing the message of Christ lead you into hip hop?
That's a funny story. My uncles were big into hip hop. They were kind of kids in the 80s, and hip hop was this phenomenon. You know, my mother worked at a halfway house, and some of the guys who would get out of prison, they were listening to hip hop and they would give me mixtapes. So by the time I'm 19 years old, which is when I had my spiritual transformation, I was already like a product of the culture of hip hop. It was just now, like, how do I articulate this newfound worldview that I had and these new values with the same kind of skill set and form of expression that I had grown up with?
Because I think most people don't automatically associate hip hop and Christianity.
No. Yeah, they're legitimately two different worlds. Hip hop is, you know, this kind of anti-establishment movement that was formed by these rebellious kids. And so oftentimes Christianity in America looks like establishment. It looks political. It looks, you know, like restrictions.
I'm still in America, where church is a Broadway production for relevance. We traded the kingdom to build an empire, so people don't trust us, apparently. We worship economy. We'll kill our own babies to keep our autonomy. You mess with our Second Amendment, we probably gonna riot,
but take out the probably.
And so they don't really mesh well together. And hip-hop speaks to the social issues, whereas Christianity hasn't really done much of that since the Civil Rights Movement.
So when your first album, Real Talk, came out in 2004, who was that audience that really latched onto it?
So initially, I mean, it was this very small niche of kids within hip-hop who had become Christians. Similar to mainstream hip-hop, the suburbs got a hold of it. And so you've now got these suburban kind of evangelical kids who are like, we found something that our parents will let us listen to.
And we pray, and we pray, and we pray.
Was there ever a time when things maybe got slightly uncomfortable? When, say, maybe you started speaking out on things that Christians might not be too keen on listening to, say, racial justice?
I had that innate sense that I was here for the needs of the marginalized and disenfranchised. And so to see a Michael Brown get killed, regardless of his background, for me was traumatizing and devastating. And I thought that, you know, I could just share that with my Christian brothers and sisters, regardless of their ethnicity, via social media, the pain that I was experiencing. And I was met with such like criticism and blowback. I was confused.
What were people most critical of?
They began to think I was a Marxist or some kind of apostate who was veering from the faith and a heretic, caring more about ethnicity and race than faith.
So, Lecrae, I used to be very, very involved in the Christian church for a long time, into my early 20s. And one of the things I remember about it the most is that when you finally give your life to Jesus Christ, you kind of, everything about you melts away and you're no longer who you were before. Now you're a follower of Christ. So it doesn't matter if you're like me, brown, or if you're you, black, that goes away and now you become a different kind of being. Was that something that you heard, or is that something that you kind of came up against?
Yeah, I think that was implied, right? Because people would say things like, we don't see color, you know, we're all covered by the blood of Jesus. And so it was kind of this idea that we're all unified, which is very utopian, but it's not a reality. You know, the reality is people do see my color. They do have biases once they see us. I can't explain the 400 years of chattel slavery in America. Maybe God did that so that we could know Jesus. And, you know, you just start kind of washing away any kinds of thoughts that would have some cultural or ethnic implications. But it did begin to create a lot of internal strife for me.
Now, okay, so this brings us to Church Close 4. It's the fourth volume in a series of mixtapes that started in the summer of 2012. The first song of Church Close 4 opens up.
R.I.P. Breonna Taylor, R.I.P. to George Floyd. I ain't trying to hate on my own kind, but why not gain my only choice? And Herschel either, I love believers, but some of these folks don't rep the kingdom.
You mentioned Breonna Taylor, you mentioned George Floyd. When Christians hear that, do they embrace the message that you're trying to put out, or is this something that makes them kind of like cringe a little bit in their seat?
Oh, they definitely cringe. You know, if you're from the more conservative evangelical ilk, you're cringing at that because there's a whole kind of campaign against bringing up any type of ethnic trauma. It's wokeness, it's CRT. I'm not lionizing them, I'm humanizing them and making sure that we can see them.
So Church Close 4 is the fourth in a series of mixtapes that you've put out over the years. Is this some kind of end of the road or end of the race?
I think, obviously, like you said, it's a series. It doesn't mean I won't make music anymore. It just means this particular series has come to an end. It's kind of like, hey, let me kind of close out this series speaking to some of the things that need to be addressed within the church and to the outside world.
And when you say, Lord, help me kill all my demons.
Lord, help me kill all my demons. I look in the mirror, I seen them. I had a bee in my foster to get an abortion. I pray when I die, I can meet them.
Are you talking about demons in the past, present, and the ones you might face in the future? Because I think no matter what, whether you're a believer or not, you're going to have demons.
They won't catch me like
it. Yeah, you absolutely nailed it. This is an admittance of my imperfection. And I'm not a Christian because I'm the model citizen. I'm a Christian because I know the depth of my kind of depravity and the thoughts and the things that go on with me. And I do need consistent help. I do need a savior. So, it's saying I realize that I'm going to be dealing with trouble. I'm going to deal with issues for the rest of my life.
That's rapper Lecrae. His new mixtape is called Church Close 4. Lecrae, thanks a lot.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Alex Crowe. You've been listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. You can hear it from 5 to 9 each weekday here on WPR News and then Morning Classics next.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio is provided by the Lee Esther News Fellowship, providing early career journalists the opportunity to learn hands-on reporting, editing, and broadcasting in a professional setting as part of the WPR News Department.
24/7 Jazz HD2 is available on your smartphone. For jazz, big band, and blues, go to the App Store and download the free WGTD app. HD2 is still available on your desktop at WGTD.org and in the Kenosha Racine area on your HD radio.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public.